Today I'll continue this series of talks that we're giving on this retreat on the Four Noble Truths by talking about the third Noble Truth. The Four Noble Truths as a whole are the good news of Buddhism. And particularly so now that we're turning a corner in the talks, focusing on the third and fourth. 2 days ago I gave a talk on the first noble truth of the truth of suffering, and I felt slightly bad just leaving you to suffer. But I knew that if you just hung in there a couple of days, you'd get to this part of the talk. And so the third noble truth is a truth of the cessation of suffering. And the traditional way it's described is goes something like this. The third noble truth is the truth of the cessation of suffering. It is the extinguishing, uprooting, letting go of that craving that is referred to in the second noble truth. And so it's almost treated as synonymous, the cessation, the ending of suffering, and the uprooting or the letting go of craving. And it's very important to see that the third noble truth refers to a change that happens with craving, and letting go of craving, the cessation of craving. Because it's very easy to let go of the wrong things. What we're asked in Buddhism to let go of is the compulsion, the drivenness, that's a more of a psychological movement within us. We're not necessarily asked to let go of anything in the world. Things in the world are as they are, and it's our relationship to those things which is really the key. And so here this points directly to the cessation or the letting go of craving towards things. You might still have things you relate to or involved in things, but you don't no longer cling to them. But you haven't dismissed them or discarded them. The first and second noble truths describe the world of suffering. The third and fourth describes the world of peace, of happiness, of freedom. There's a long tradition in Buddhism to represent suffering by fire. In one of the great Dharma talks the Buddha gave, he talked about the whole world's on fire. And we say that sometimes in English too, you know, people are on fire with anger, or the fever of lust, or a variety of things, kind of hot-headed. And so this is a fire of suffering that we experience. And that's the first noble truth. The second noble truth is the fuel that keeps the fire going. The fire requires fuel. And so the second noble truth is the fuel, and that's made explicit in the Buddha's teachings, because the word for fuel and the word for clinging are homonyms. They're the same word. And so to cling is the fuel for further clinging, for further suffering. And then the practice of Buddhism is the cool water that extinguishes the flames, the fever. And this talking about suffering as being fire is even more poignant in India, where the Buddha lived, because it can be a very hot climate. And so the idea of extinguishing fire, being cooled down, nirvana sometimes called the cooling, the great cooling down. And so in a hot climate, to be cooled is to be refreshed. For, you know, they say that, English comes from England. And it's not always that hot in England. And so in England, they, there they talk about having a warm heart as being a nice thing. A cool heart is kind of like cold-hearted, not so good. But in India, being cold-hearted, cool-hearted, was considered an ideal, is great. But they had a different reference point, different meaning of it because of the climates. So the idea of cooling down, maybe some of you need to warm up. Sometimes we get kind of so locked in and tight in our attachments that that things kind of shut down and go cold. But practice is the water, the refreshing water. Mindfulness is the water. That's the medicine for our suffering, for our clinging. So the fourth noble truth, the path, is the water. And then the third noble truth is the extinguishing of the flames, the fire. Now it's common enough in the discussions of the Four Noble Truths to describe them in ultimate terms. And in fact, in Andrea's wonderful talk that she gave, the overview of it, was wonderful. I thought it was a great talk, overview of it. But she brought in the concept of nirvana, nibbana, in her discussion of the Third Noble Truth, and which was an appropriate thing to do. But what happens sometimes is that quickly referring the Four Noble Truths to ultimate liberation, ultimate freedom, it can seem to be something that's distant from our life here and now, something which is not, kind of foreign to us, something maybe we can hope to dream maybe someday, maybe next lifetime, that's something I can do as well. It can also, therefore, that way also seem kind of irrelevant to our life here and now. But the Four Noble Truths are imminently relevant to our ordinary everyday life. And in fact, it might be very useful to take a little time to reflect on how they play themselves out in our everyday life every day. And in fact, the Four Noble Truths, I think, are something that everyone is familiar with the whole world over. They're not really that foreign and strange. Just maybe the formulation the Buddha came with seems a little bit cryptic at first or a little bit formulaic. But it's possible, I think, to reflect that you already practice the Four Noble Truths. You probably practiced them even before you encountered Buddhism, before you even heard about them. They're so ordinary. And I think it's useful to actually reflect and notice all the ways in which you're already practicing the Four Noble Truths in your daily life, rather than holding up the ideal of, that's far in the distance, or some, the Big Bang theory of enlightenment. So what are some of the ordinary ways that you practice the Four Noble Truths? I don't know if this is how ordinary this is, but it comes to mind, kind of an example perhaps from here in the kitchen. I can imagine that one of these days that Nancy and Greg will put out maybe chocolate. Have you done that already for everyone?
Last night. After the chocolate ice cream and the M&Ms and the Hershey bars.
Okay. So maybe it's already happened. You practice the Four Noble Truths with the chocolate. But I can imagine someone having, a little bar of chocolate, a little square. That was really good. And that was really nice and comforting. I probably deserved that after all the struggles of the day. And that was really nice. How nice. And, I probably deserve another one. I really made extra effort. And if a little bit more pleasure would be good. And so you go back and you open the door and you see there's one left. and there's someone else in the kitchen, and they're heading for that one chocolate too, and your heart races, and you can't believe what's about to happen, and you know, can't really realize that how important this is. You've been dreaming about this chocolate piece for the last 5 minutes. And should you scream? Should you say, stop? You know, that was mine. I think my name is on it. And the person reaches out and takes it. And there's no chocolate left. So your desire, all the meaning you had around the chocolate, you deserve it. It was a comfort food for the struggles you had for the day. Here you're frustrated. The frustrated desire is a kind of suffering. And perhaps it's, you know, really worked up. You get really hot about this. The injustice of it all. And what is this with IMC? That they doesn't give Nancy a big enough budget to buy lots of chocolate. And so the fury builds. And then after a while, you realize this is not very useful to have this anger. And you say, the anger, so then you kind of look at the anger a little bit, which is the, you see, oh, I'm suffering here. And I've learned that there's a healthy way to look at that suffering. If I fuel my anger at IMC and complain and write a letter to the president's board, then it's not, you know, that's assigning blame and all that. That's not really the source of the problem. I really need to look at it here with myself. And that's the right view. That's the first of the Eightfold Path, to know where the appropriate place to put your attention. I need to take responsibility for this myself. And I think I better not yell at that person, because that's going to cause harm. And that's the second of the Eightfold Path. And then added to that might be other, right actions, right ethics. Kind of start restraining yourself and containing yourself. And then you see, it's not so useful for me to spin out my thoughts and feelings around this chocolate. But I'm really worked up about it. So it's not healthy to kind of keep being worked up about it. I need to do something different that cools me down. So I think what will help me is go for a walk. That would be a skillful thing to do. I'll go for a long walk down the property and take in the greenery and stuff. And that's the sixth step of the Eightfold Path. Letting go of what's unskillful and cultivating what's skillful. And then let's be mindful of this whole thing. Let's hold it in my awareness. Let's be mindful. And let's develop a little more stability and calm and concentration here, so that I can go back to the next sitting and not be steaming. So it's kind of maybe a dramatic story, but I can imagine someone going through those steps without ever having heard about the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Steps. It's just kind of like, you know, I'm upset. It's not useful, the direction my thinking is going. I need to take responsibility for it here. I need to do something about it. I going for a walk is useful. I better restrain my impulses to be unskillful. And let's be mindful of this, so I'm careful. And it, right in there is found the Four Noble Truths. I suspect that, and in part of that, and with that comes a seizing eventually, the quieting down, first a calming and quieting down of all the momentum and agitation that's come up from the desire and the clinging that you had. And a part of that is also the letting go and the seizing of that clinging. Some situations in daily life, it's really easy to let go. And I think letting go happens 1,000 times a day for people. It's an ordinary, absolutely ordinary thing to do. I mean, really ordinary would be that you're ready to go through a door and someone is just there just at the same time. So you let go of your desire to go through the door for the moment and let someone else go through in front of you. Or you see you're at lunch and you see that there are there's only one piece of chocolate left. So you break it in half. You let go of half of it so someone else could have the other half. Or, you know, you offer something. Or you're sitting here and, you know, you meditating away and you hear some staff person at Hidden Villa talking outside. The first year we were here, we had this wonderful tour guide who took people on tours, I remember. And he came and gave a wonderful docent kind of lecture about the plants just outside the window here. You know, it wasn't exactly entertaining, but... And then, so that was okay. And an hour later, he came back with another group and gave exactly the same talk. And that was a little more challenging. But so then, I have to let go of that. Okay, I had an expectation. It's supposed to be silent. And if I hold on to that expectation, I'll suffer. So I'll let go of that expectation, that expectation that it should be silent here, and let me just practice with the sound. This is how it is. I suspect that all of you have let go of a lot of stuff, a lot of small things. Many things are so small that you don't even think of it as letting go. It's just so ordinary part of life. Sometimes you see that you're suffering, you're uncomfortable, you're frustrated, and you see, I'm frustrated because of what I'm holding on to, what I'm expecting, what I'm demanding, and it's relatively easy to let go of it. Thank you, I let go. It doesn't have to be this way. And if you do the exercise, or begin from the point of view that the Four Noble Truths are things that you're already familiar with, then it's possible to focus on how to expand and develop, enhance what you're already doing. As opposed to reading his wonderful book about Buddhist philosophy and thinking this is a great world religion, it has great authority as a world religion, and this is, you know, the great shoulds, and I should really do this, you know, and be a really good religious kind of person, and I need to kind of import from this book, from the Buddha, this teaching, and how do I do this thing, this Four Noble Truth? It's a very different approach if you import it or if you export it. And I'd suggest that Buddhism works a lot better if you're an exporter, meaning that you rediscover it in yourself and you expand it, you develop, you strengthen, you cultivate it, rather than take on something which is not really your own. So that's why looking at the ordinary places first can be very helpful. In some areas of life, it's really easy to let go. Some areas of practice, it's easy to let go. Some areas of life, it's not so easy, but it's possible with effort. In some areas of life, it's not really possible to let go as you currently are. But it's possible to prepare yourself. It's possible to develop yourself so that at some point you can let go of some of the big things that life will ask you to let go of. If you start with the big things, they can be frustrating. If you appreciate there's a range, then you can begin maybe in the places where it's possible to do it, or where you can stretch yourself a little bit to do it. And I would like to suggest that in probably every situation that's difficult and challenging, there's probably small ways to let go around the edges of the great difficulty. So, for example, a person might be very deeply afraid of something, and it's hard to address the fear directly. But how can we let go in small ways around the fear? Perhaps the fear of the fear. Or perhaps there's a little place of embarrassment that I'm a fearful person. And I can't let go of the fear, but perhaps that identity and the way that I'm worried about what other people say or think about me because they see me being afraid, maybe I can let go of that. Or maybe that's too big. Maybe even step back further. Maybe there's an even outer layer of something that's relatively easy to let go about in the fear. And perhaps it's letting go of denying it's there. Or perhaps it's letting go of a kind of subtle resistance to it, or a strong resistance to it. I don't know. So what I'm trying to suggest is that even with the great difficulties, perhaps we can start where it's easy. And so step back and look. You know, where can you begin that's relatively easy, rather than jumping into the very middle of the fire? And sometimes by chipping away at the outside, we can get closer and closer in an easier way, safer way, more relaxed way, more realistic way, than if we go right into the middle. I've known people, and also myself, where working with the fear was too great to go into because I was afraid of the fear. So I paid a lot of attention to the fear of the fear. That was safe enough because then fear of the fear is not what I was afraid of. So that was okay to go hang out with that. And when the fear of the fear settled away, then it wasn't so bad to go into the fear. It was kind of like a little trick. Maybe. Step back. Where is it easy? So the third noble truth is the truth of letting go. And just as with the first noble truth, we study suffering, so in the second noble truth, I think it's helpful to study letting go, to understand the nature of letting go, the different ways of letting go. And even more than understanding it, studying it, I think it's very helpful for the heart to appreciate letting go. So in those movements in daily life that where you do let go, and it's you're better because of it, to take a little bit of a few moments to appreciate and value what you've done, what's happened, the results. So it nourishes you, so it reminds you, so it conditions you, well, this is a good thing to do. So you're developing both the muscle of letting go, but you're also developing a greater valuing of this whole process of letting go. But in studying letting go, one of the things that's very important, I think, to investigate is the difference between healthy letting go and unhealthy letting go. I've known plenty of Buddhists who hear about letting go from their teachers, and they get on this a little bit too zealot about letting go. And they let go of things they should never let go of. I've known people who have let go of all their money. It could be useful to let go of your money. Some people do that and find it helpful. But the key is not letting go of the money, but letting go of the clinging to it. I've known people who have let go of their sexuality. And it can be useful sometimes to do that, or some people find that's a life that really works for them, to be a celibate life. But what's important is the clinging and the grasping connected to it. That's what's the issue. And so there's a whole list of things where there's confusion between the object of clinging and the clinging itself. And so we study, you know, what are we letting go of here? Sometimes we let go of the object, because that's part of the training, what helps us to let go of the clinging. So, for example, addiction to alcohol. It's very hard to let go of alcohol without actually stopping drinking alcohol. So sometimes you let go of the object, but it's really for the service of this inner movement of freedom. Sometimes the unhealthy forms of letting go is when people let go out of a sense of duty. A good Buddhist should let go. obligation or politeness. I'm supposed to let go. It's a polite thing, the right thing to do. I don't think that it's very helpful to operate under duty or excessive politeness, obligation. It's important to, because then it's not really understood very deeply. Another unhealthy way of letting go is a form of I don't count. I'm not important enough to hold on to this or have these things. I'm kind of a self-diminishing self-effacement. I don't count, so I just have to kind of back up and let go. I didn't really deserve that chocolate. I had a hard day today because I'm just kind of a meditation klutz. And I don't deserve it. Maybe someday I'll deserve the great chocolate. And so kind of a dismissing of ourselves. There can be kind of unhealthy or unskillful letting go when we let go out of aversion or out of fear. I'm afraid of myself. I'm afraid of my desires. And so I let go of my desires because I don't know how to handle them. Or I think that maybe my desires are not okay to have desires. And then there's healthy letting go. And healthy letting go, I think, begins by having some wisdom, deeper understanding about what's really going on, to understand the connection between suffering and clinging, grasping, and to wisely see, I don't have to live this life of suffering. It's not healthy, it's not helpful for me or for others. So is there some way, then, appropriate way, where I can let go of this grasping? It's a healthy letting go brings a sense of well-being or peace. It kind of brings a sense of greater good. Is it for the greater good to let go? I learned the hard way that if I let go and I don't feel any joy or any light, not lightened, somehow lightened by it, by that experience, chances are it's going to come back and bite me. I did this. I learned this with my kid was really young. I had to let go a lot as a parent. Boy, there was a lot of letting go. And I thought I knew something about letting go until I had kids. And there were times I thought, oh yeah, I let go. That's. And I would get grumpier and grumpier, resentful. If I saw that if I was resentful or got grumpy, I hadn't really let go. So I learned from that if there isn't some kind of lightening or opening or sense of well-being, something, different situations has different forms. Sometimes it's clearly a joy that comes. That if there's something like that, that then I probably haven't let go thoroughly or fully, or haven't discovered what really needs to be let go of. There's something satisfying about healthy letting go. Now, the more well-being a person has, the more peace a person experiences, the calmer a person is, the better reference point a person would have for the benefits that come from letting go. So So what I'm trying to say is like this. So say that you're running around town, frantically doing 10 things at once, frustrated that things are not working out. And you're racing along in your car, and you see in the distance that the traffic light is green. And your heart races, and your stomach clenches, and it's like, I've got to get there before it turns red, because I don't want to be later than I am. So that's clinging right there, ordinary clinging. So some wisdom sets in. Say, oh, look at that, I'm clenching my stomach, my heart is racing, I'm going to race to get that, make that green light. I think I'll let go of that. So that's nice to let go. However, because you're so frantic and so tense anyway, then letting go, you let go into a place, you feel a little bit better, but basically you let go into a system that's pretty tense. Now think of yourself, you know, you've been on retreat for a week, you will be in a few days, and you're pretty calm and relaxed and open and settled, and you're driving home, and you see a green light up there. I better, you know, same for now. I want to get home soon, so I'll race along here. I'll try to get that. And you feel the clenching of the stomach. You feel the racing. And the wisdom sets in. You say, no, I don't need to do this. So you let go of that clinging to making the green light. But now when you let go, you can let go into this deeper states of calm that you had after sitting for a week. There's a greater benefit seen in letting go when you have a capacity for greater peace. Does that make sense, what I'm trying to say? And so as people practice, there becomes a different reference point for the satisfaction, the meaning, the value of letting go, that someone who's living a tense life, preoccupied life, could never imagine. So then back again to the ordinary sufferings and letting goes that we have in daily life. One of the things that I think can be helpful is in some simple thing we have to, you know, simple clinging that arises and we let go, is that you can see that it arises. You see that it gets born. And there's something very helpful about seeing something that seeing it doesn't exist, and now it comes into being, it comes into existence. So driving down the road, minding your own business, calm, seeing the green light in the distance, wondering whether you'll make it. And then wondering you make it, and then wanting to make it, wanting to beat that green light, feeling the contraction of the stomach or the tightening around your gas pedal foot. And you can see the arising, the occurring of that clenching. And when you see it arise out of kind of nothing, in a sense, arise out of a time when it wasn't there, I find that it's a lot easier to understand that it's optional. It doesn't have to be there all the time. To see that it arises makes it easier to see it's a possibility that it'll pass. To see the arising and see the passing of it. Buddhism emphasizes there's a lot of value in seeing something arise and knowing that it'll pass, or there's a possibility of it passing. And part of the benefit of mindfulness is hopefully we can be mindful enough to catch those moments of arising when the clinging begins to occur. And when it starts to arise, there's actually often much more possibility to let go than it is when when the clinging has arisen all the way, completely, full blown clinging attack. And when we can see the arising of clinging, grasping, against a backdrop of calm or peace or subtleness, it becomes even easier to want to let go and also to let go. And so when it's really hard to let go of something, sometimes it's best maybe not to try to let go of it directly, but find some way to calm down, to settle down. Create a backdrop or a container or a condition of peace so that the clinging gets highlighted. In that highlighted situation, it's sometimes easier to let go or see that it's useful to let go. When you study clinging, one of the things you'll probably discover is all the lawyers in the mind that will argue to you why it's necessary to cling, why it's important not to let go. And there are some really good arguments in there. And sometimes you have to wrestle with those lawyers. But they get paid a lot of money, so, you know, they can be quite persuasive. One of the things that I found very useful, one of the great treasures that one of the things I very much treasure from learning mindfulness practice, is the role of the body, of being mindful of the body. There's so much wisdom, so much understanding, so much information, so much support that happens through staying connected in your body. It's such an anchor, it's such a stabilizer, it's a ballast. It provides a lot of safety to stay connected to your body. Body's always in the present moment. But in terms of letting go, I find that one of the ways that helps me to let go at times is to identify how physically I clutch and hold on when I'm holding on psychologically to something. And now, you know, I can tighten up my belly, my shoulders, my face, my jaws, my eyes, my hands, my thighs, just about anywhere I'm capable of. And it's very interesting to see that at different times, different situations, the different muscles come into play. You know, maybe different emotions. And sometimes I felt, you know, it's kind of whole body, it's braced, kind of bracing myself against life, and that's the form of clinging. But to identify and feel it in the body, and then sometimes it's easier, I can't necessarily let go of the psychological clinging so easily, but I can begin the process of relaxing the body, letting go of the tightness in my stomach, having a soft belly, or in my shoulders. Or if I identify the physical place if there's a physical place of clutching or holding, maybe I can't even let go of that. But I find it very helpful to hold the attention there, to hold that in awareness. Because it's a way of kind of being present for the clinging in a tangible, concrete way that's sustainable over time. Just to be there. And you shouldn't underestimate the tremendous value of just holding something in awareness. Or coming to the place where you can hold something in awareness without secondary or tertiary clingings and resistance on top of it. Again, the relationship we have is so important. And so I find doing it in the body, discovering what's going on in the body, very helpful. So the third noble truth has to do with the cessation of suffering, which has a lot to do with the cessation of grasping, of clinging. And sometimes that cessation of clinging happens by letting go. Sometimes we let go. Many times letting go happens by itself. Sometimes we can see letting go, and sometimes we don't see it, how it happens. I have wasted a lot of time on retreat, waiting, watching like a cat at a mouse door, waiting to see the moment when I finally let go of something, when I finally release something. And sitting there waiting, I said, let go. When is it going to let go? It has to let go. I'm going to see it let go. You know, soon enough, you know. And by then, by the end of the sitting, nothing's changed. And then I go out and do my walking period, maybe have lunch, and come back and sit down. It's gone. Where did it go? I didn't see it. And after, you know, I'm kind of a slow learner. After a few hundred times of that, I finally dawned on me that maybe I'm not going to see how the clinging goes away. I have to do my practice, I have to be mindful and be present. Sometimes I'll see it, sometimes I'll see where there's choice and I can let go, and sometimes letting go happens on its own. And it was a waste of time to be waiting and expecting and taking responsibility that I'm supposed to do this. A lot happens on its own. Seeing the truth provides, you know, opens up the process. But I wanted to mention four different kinds of letting go for your study. You can look at your life and see how these might work. The first is letting go of something. So, you know, let go of your conceit or your identity. Let go of what people are thinking about you. Let them think whatever they want. Let go of wanting to be liked. Let go of hiding, not revealing yourself to others. Letting go of your fear. Letting go of your clinging to chocolate. Whatever it might be. That's the most common form of letting go that when people think about letting go. Another form of letting go, which is much closer to the heart of mindfulness practice, is called letting be. Let something just be. You don't have to let go of it when you do mindfulness practice. There's a kind of letting go that happens when you just let something be. Because letting be, what we let go of, is the movement to not let it be. To try to fix it, to try to push it away, improve on it, hold on to it. Just let things be as they are. Let it be. It's very respectful to your inner life, to reality, to life, to the innate process of our life, to let go of our taking agency all the time, our taking always responsibility. It's up to me to fix it, up to me to do all this stuff. And just let things be. Stop interfering. Letting be means stop interfering. I think of it as a kind of a gift we give. We let things be themselves. We let our friends be themselves by letting them be as they are. We let ourselves be as we are. It's a gift to ourselves. Let things be. It's not having any second or third arrows on our experience. Just let it be. I associate this with being still, where the awareness, something inside of us becomes still, even though there's movement and activity perhaps in the mind. So like, you know, your mind is busy and thinking a lot. There's a lot of movement in the mind. Instead of letting go, maybe you can't let go of the thinking mind. But maybe it's very profound to let it be. But you let it be while trying to be still with your awareness. And it's from a still place, as still as you can find, know the busy mind. To feel it. To let it be is to begin finding a place of stillness. What's very what a big part of what we're grappling with in Buddhism, or working with in Buddhism, is the mind that's always active. And much of our suffering has to do with what in Buddhism is called constructions, formations. We're co-creating, we're creating ourselves, we're creating much of our world around us, we're creating our sense of self, we're creating our relationship to everything. And the mind is actually much busier than most people realize. And the good news is that a lot of this activity is extra. And it's not a matter of fixing the activity, as it is stilling the activity. And letting things be is a profound way of coming to stillness. And if you have the idea, how can I have the mindfulness, the awareness be still here? You know, we have this funny expression in English, bringing the mind back, or move your attention to your knee, put your attention in your breathing, as if attention of the mind is something you move around. But the mind doesn't move at all. The mind can be still and attentive and aware. To allow the mind, not don't move. Next time you're going to pay attention to your breath, don't move your mind. Let the breathing come into the mind. Next time you're going to pay careful attention to sound, don't move your mind towards the sound. Let your mind not move, but be sensitive and open. The sound will come to you. To let the mind be still. So letting be is very profound. Another form of letting go is to let in, to let something in, to trust, to feel, to not resist, to let in maybe your fear, to let in what you're holding off at bay. Open to it. Allow yourself to feel it. People spend a lot of time resisting themselves or resisting life. What happens if we don't resist, but let it in? Let in the suffering of the world. Let in the love of a friend. Let in the laughter of a neighbor. Let in the sorrow, your own sorrow. Sometimes letting in is a form of letting go, because we let go of the resistance to what's there. The fourth kind of letting go is letting go into. It's not only a matter of letting go of something, but there's another side, there's a benefit that can come from letting go. We let us let go into something. I like the analogy of maybe it's a hot day, you're at the edge of the pool, you want to go in, and so you let go of the diving board, let go of the edge of the pool, and in doing that, you plunge into the refreshing, cool pool of water. It's not just a matter of letting go of the edge, it's also with that letting go, you let go into something, into the pool. It's possible to let go of agitation and let go into a feeling of calm. It's possible to let go of fear and let go into a feeling of a little bit greater safety, perhaps. It's possible to let go of clinging to something and let go into a sense of well-being or peace. It's not always accessible or possible, this here. But sometimes if we only let go of something, it can seem like an impoverishment. We're letting, it's all about it being... But if we let go into something, it's about what's gained in the letting go. And ultimately in Buddhism, I believe, we're not asked to let go because we're supposed to become impoverished or diminished by it. It's letting go is really supposed to enhance us. It's supposed to kind of be for our benefit. It's for the greater good. And so what is that greater good that we can let go into? We let go of our resistance, perhaps, so we can let go into a greater sensitivity, perhaps a greater empathy. And so you might, and so one of the things that comes with practice is that as practice matures and develops, there's a greater range of understanding of what we can let go into, what's available to us here. We can let go into a spaciousness, an openness, a clarity. So to let go of, to let be, to let in, and let go into. Now, one of the remarkable things about the Four Noble Truths is that in that they sit at the heart of Buddhism, the core of Buddhism, Buddhism offers you something, one of these great religions, offers you something which is not metaphysical. The heart of this religion is not supernatural. It's something which is very simple and available and immediate that billions of non-Buddhists even do without knowing it. What Buddhism does, it takes this very ordinary thing and then we really enter into it and develop it and strengthen it and take it as far as we possibly can in our lives. And the Buddha is meant to be an example of this. Buddha is supposed to be an example, whether it's an archetype or true, whether it's or not. The Buddha represents that capacity to let go completely of the clinging, of grasping, so that the heart, the mind, is no way contracted, constricted, resisting, fully open. And to have a religion that has its non-metaphysical basis means for me that the goal of Buddhism is not an attainment. It's not that you're going to attain something, but rather you're going to realize something. You're going to realize something in a sense, almost like it's already here. It's not like you're going to huff and puff and build and create something that's not here now or attain something far in the distance. But you're going to realize something which is already, which is a potential you have. It's something right here, close in. It's very intimate. And so in the example of the Buddha, the image of the Buddha, the image of a person who sat under a tree, who sat on the ground, who had an image of a person who represents a kind of beautiful simplicity of being, who represents or shows us how little is really needed for us to be at peace, to be grounded, to be deeply at home in this world, to be free. It's a reference point for all the things we want and don't want and desire and don't desire and resist and think we need to have for our lives. And here's this man who's sitting there peacefully, walking around peacefully, had very few possessions, who was recognized at his time to be really happy. The Mahasukha, the greatly happy one. He let go of wealth, the pursuit of wealth. So many of the pursuits that people pursue to become happy are perhaps looking for happiness in the wrong place. Not that those pursuits are not worthwhile, but perhaps the happiness is found in a radical simplicity of being, where the heart, the mind, can be happily still, quiet. Just to be alive is enough. The Buddha sat there on the ground, not needing anything from anybody. He didn't define himself. In that simplicity of being, there was no need to be defined. For an identity. So the Buddha represents this kind of very thoroughgoing possibility of something which in essence is so ordinary and simple. Sitting under a tree on the ground at peace. It's not meant to be this lofty attainment. I think. But a grounded presence. And just like with the Four Noble Truths, don't take this great attainment or realization of the Buddha to be something lofty and inaccessible. When have you experienced states of peace? Ordinary states of peace. Some people experience it in nature. Some of you maybe experience it on retreat. Some people maybe at your home, quiet time at home. What's the nature of that peace that you experience? What's the nature when you've extinguished the clinging and it's peaceful? What's that peace like? Can we appreciate the peace and appreciate the still, how so much has become still? Greed, hate, and delusion, fear, resistance, anger have become still, have stilled, become stilled. It's almost as if it's our birthright, that peace. It's there. It's there, it's in a, kind of innate, not because, almost because it's there when there's an absence of all this other stuff. And then to kind of tie all this together, and bring it back to mindfulness. As you develop and cultivate your mindfulness, be on the lookout for the day when you notice, you can see that a moment of mindfulness, a moment of clear mindfulness, it has no clinging in it. Even though there might be clinging in your mind, the clear mindfulness of the clinging has no clinging. A clear moment of mindfulness of something has in it a letting be, has in it a letting go, has in it peace, has in it stillness. To sit here and to be mindful, to know what's happening, and to feel and sense the peace. peace or the stillness that's within that mindfulness. Around it might be churning and swirling, many feelings and thoughts, sensations. But the mindfulness can just know. The mindfulness itself, the knowing itself, can be a place of peace. And each of us have a right, each of us has the possibility to let go and be at peace. It's not a lofty goal. It's more like water flows downhill to the lowest point. So then we can sit here stilly, in stillness for a few minutes, let this swirl around and settle. In the clarity of mindfulness, things can be just the way they are. And in the mindfulness, there is the letting go, the letting be. In the mindfulness, there is the peace.